From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The man accused of raping and killing little Megan Kenka is on trial. We look at Megan's Law. Would it have saved even Megan? Then it's a job more dangerous than being a minor. Today we expose the epidemic of healthcare worker injury in the United States. And the UN War Crimes Tribunal convicts a Bosnian Serb of ethnic cleansing. We look at the UN's role in the betrayal and fall of Srebrenica, Europe's worst massacre since World War II. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Bosnian Serb police reservist was found guilty by the UN Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia yesterday of war crimes and crimes against humanity for his part in a Serb ethnic cleansing campaign against Bosnian Muslims. The judgment in the case of Dusan Dusko Tadic was the first in a full-length trial since the tribunal was set up by the UN Security Council in May of 1993. The UN tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda mark the first attempt to try war criminals before an international panel of judges since the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials after World War II. We'll have more on that story later in the show. This news from Pennsylvania. As a crowd of supporters cheered wildly, a white officer who struck the first blow against black motorist Johnny Gamage was promoted to sergeant and given a raise. Officer John Voitis of Brentwood, a suburb of Pittsburgh, was promoted by a unanimous vote at the borough council meeting yesterday. The crowd at the borough offices was overwhelmingly in favor of the promotion. Voitis was and four other white officers fought Johnny Gamage, a black businessman from Syracuse, New York, after a traffic stop near the Brentwood-Pittsburgh border on October 12, 1995. Johnny Gamage later died. An all-white jury acquitted Voitis of involuntary manslaughter in November. Two other officers were charged but went free after a mistrial and a judge's ruling last month that headed off a second trial. Two other officers were not charged at all. But this is not the only trouble for Voitis. Let me go down in the story, and it says that officers held Gamage against the pavement. He died of pressure on his neck and back. Gamage bit Voitis's thumb to the bone. Voitis also has been the subject of abuse allegations brought by his former girlfriends. In 1993, a small group of Brentwood residents led by the mother of Voitis's fiancée, Judith Barrett, called for his dismissal after Barrett was found dead at a bus stop. A coroner found that she had shot herself with Voitis's police revolver. Barrett's mother, Lillian Barrett, said she believes frequent beatings by Voitis brought on her daughter's death. Also, Lisa Leitner, a former girlfriend of Voitis and the mother of his two children, complained that he abused her both physically and verbally several times from 1987 to 1993. She obtained three protection from abuse orders. Again, John Voitis, who struck the first blow against Johnny Gamage, has been promoted. This news from Detroit. Bargainers reached agreement on a key outsourcing issue in the longest strike against Chrysler Corporation in 30 years. But negotiators for Chrysler and the United Auto Workers fell short of finalizing a local contract for engine plant workers whose walkout has idled factories across North America. Strikes also continue today at General Motors Corporation assembly plants in Oklahoma City and Pontiac. The Senate Intelligence Committee will go behind closed doors today in its confirmation hearings for George Tenet, the president's nominee, to run the Central Intelligence Agency. The closed session will give members and Tenet the chance to discuss classified information. So far, Tenet has told the panel that he believes the CIA must change its focus from the Cold War to new threats such as terrorism, weapons proliferation, and drug trafficking. Tenet is being questioned in a much friendlier atmosphere than the one greeted Anthony Lake, President Clinton's first choice to head the CIA. Lake withdrew under intense scrutiny over links between politics and foreign policy at the White House. A U.S. government report says America didn't press hard enough after World War II to make sure Switzerland returned gold the Nazis looted from European central banks. A U.S. official says the report, due out this morning, criticizes Switzerland for avoiding moral questions concerning its acceptance of gold stolen by Germany. This news from Jackson, Mississippi. Former state tax commissioner Harvey Johnson upset incumbent Mayor Kane Ditto in the Democratic primary yesterday in his quest to become Jackson's first black mayor. Harvey Johnson overwhelmingly defeated five Democrats, including Ditto. He called it a victory of a poor country boy from Vicksburg. A Chinese court has sentenced three Tibetans, including two former officials, to jail terms of up to 6 years for separatism and leaking state secrets after a trial behind closed doors. China has come under fire from human rights groups and Western governments for its treatment of those seeking independence for Tibet. In March, the European Parliament accused China of persistent human rights violations in Tibet and urged Beijing to end its refusal to negotiate the Himalayan region's future with its exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. And finally, Zaire's president, Mobutu Sese Seko, arrived in Gabon's capital of Libreville today for a regional summit on efforts to broker peace in Zaire. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In New Jersey, the murder of, or the alleged murderer of, 7-year-old Megan Kanka is on trial. The trial began this week. A 36-year-old twice-convicted sex offender is defending himself against charges that he raped and sodomized Megan and then strangled her with a leather belt 3 summers ago. His name is Jesse Temendequas. Ever since that fateful day 3 summers ago, Megan's name has become a rallying cry across the country for tough legislation against child abusers. In her home state of New Jersey, as well as in Congress and at the White House, politicians and family members of child abuse victims have pushed through variants of what has come to be called Megan's Law, a law that requires community notification if a certain type of sex offender moves into a neighborhood. Joining us to talk about this issue is first, well, my co-host Juan Gonzalez is back again today. Juan is a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
And we're also joined by Tim O'Brien, a senior writer at the New Jersey Law Journal, which is a weekly newspaper that covers law-related issues in the state of New Jersey. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tim.
Thanks, Amy.
Well, you've done some pieces on Megan's Law, one of them called Would Megan's Law Have Saved Megan? Why don't we start, before you answer that question, by just giving us the background on this case for people who aren't aware of the details.
You mean the case as opposed to the law?
Yeah, the case. Let's look at that, and then we'll look at the law.
Well, it was a brutal rape and murder of a 7-year-old girl in July 29th, 1994. The alleged murderer, Jesse Temendequas, who is on trial now, lived next door with two other former sex offenders, ex-sex offenders. They had all come out of the state penal system after doing time for sex offenses at what is known as Avenel in central New Jersey. And he allegedly lured the little girl to his house and actually his room on the promise of seeing a new puppy and tried to molest her. She apparently tried to get away, screamed, he panicked, and he then started beating her and ultimately killing her by putting a couple of plastic bags over her head. He then secreted her out of the house in a toy box and dumped her in a park about 3 miles away. And they took the cops about 24 hours to actually solve that crime. They were led to that house by neighbors who knew that sex offenders lived in that house. And they queried all three of the men very carefully, ultimately focusing on Jesse because of his actions and his apparent nervousness. And he allegedly gave them a confession, I think, the following Saturday night. Basically, that was the end of the investigation.
Now, how was it that neighbors knew that there were sex offenders in that house?
Well, this is interesting because this goes right back to the debate about the law that followed immediately and the creation of the law, which is what I wrote about. Neighbors knew that at least one man in that house was a sex offender, and some suspected that because of that, his housemates were sex offenders. And the reason they knew was that the house where the murder took place, it was the Cifelli house. The Cifelli family had lived there since the development was put up about 25 or 30 years before. Joe Cifelli was born and raised there and was accused and convicted of a child molestation of a little girl, actually in a town in Willingboro, a few miles away. He did, I think, 9 years in Avenel. And most of the people at that end of the street knew the Joseph Cifelli story. And in my research, I was convinced that they really knew the story because they knew all of the particulars. They knew who the victim was. They knew his relationship to this little girl. They knew roughly when it happened. And they knew when he came home. And it was common knowledge that people said, you know, Joey's back in the neighborhood. There was less information about the other two. But there were people on the block who were very, very leery and suspicious and had taken precautions to keep their kids away from that particular house simply because they knew the Cifelli story. And on the night of the, to answer your question, I initially learned that people in the neighborhood knew from somebody who told me. But in doing my research, I got out of the court papers one of the incident reports from one of the police officers doing the initial search for the little girl that night. And in that police report, the officer details how they were led to that house by a neighbor who said, you know, I grew up with Joe Cifelli. I knew he did time for sex offense. You should go check that house. And another young man told me that he had known about it since he was 16, and he too led them to that house.
So in essence, then Cifelli had provided lodging to former cellmates of his or people who had spent time in jail with him?
I guess you could say that. He befriended these two people, and initially Jesse Temendiquas and Brian Jenin, the third fellow, they got out roughly the same time, and they initially went to San Diego and lived there for maybe 18 months to 2 years. They came back in late 92 or early 93, and they moved in with Joey Cifelli, who was, by the way, still living there with his mother.
So why is it so significant, Tim O'Brien, that the neighbors, many of the neighbors, knew that this was a house that sex offenders lived in? Why does this matter?
Well, it matters to me, and I think the reason we did the piece, meaning the New Jersey Law Journal, is that we were looking in part as to how this law was created. And essentially, it was created on a lie. Now, a lot of legislation is done that way. The law could have been created regardless of these facts that were not known at the time. But the whole thing was premised on the "if only we knew" syndrome. And that was repeated and repeated. Nobody knew. Oh, my God, three sex offenders were living in our neighborhood and nobody knew. And that turned out to be not true. The assemblymen and the state senators who passed this bill didn't know it. And we're all surprised when they were told that that was the case.
So tell us what Megan's Law was, the original one in New Jersey, and what is the federal law now that President Clinton has signed off on?
Well, Megan's Law was not the first. I think the first was in Washington or Oregon State. I'm not sure, but it was the most specific. And it's a package of nine bills, but the heart of the package is community notification that if there is when a sex offender gets out under this law, which is not yet implemented because it is on hold, there are stays in the federal court system while the constitutionality is still being considered. But it is the heart of the law is that when an ex-offender comes out of prison, he has to go through a what is known as a three-tier system through a hearing in court to determine what tier he belongs to. If he belongs to tier one, he's considered a low risk of repeating, and there is no community notification. If he's tier two, then there is community notification, but not to the whole neighborhood, primarily to police, schools, child care centers, and so forth. If he's adjudicated as a tier three, he's considered a high risk of recidivism, and then everybody is notified, including all his neighbors, and that includes door-to-door by the police with flyers of pictures. his workplace is given out, his address is given out, and his car, pictures of his car and his license plate are given out. Everything they know about the guy is given out.
In terms of the constitutionality questions, some of them relate to the question of retroactivity of this to people who have previously been convicted before the law was implemented. Is that the basic constitutional question?
The most serious constitutional challenge, which is now before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, is whether or not it's a violation of due process and also a violation of the double jeopardy standard to have somebody go through this process and be notified after he has already served his time before this law was implemented. Can it be implemented retroactively? At the heart of that issue is whether or not notification constitutes punishment. The opponents to the law have always said it constitutes punishment because the person is going to be shunned and possibly driven out of the neighborhood. But the state Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't punishment, and that question is now before federal judges at the appellate level.
One of the amazing things to me and some of the pieces that I've written about the Megan's Law movement is that in the interviews that I conducted with law enforcement and health officials, many have indicated that 80 to 90% of the sex abuse that occurs in the country does not happen at the hands of a stranger, but happens at the hands of a family member. And that in essence that the whole movement on this law is focusing on that small part of the sexual abuse problems in the country that occur from strangers. And there seems to be no concern, or at least very little, to publicly air the tremendous problems of incest and sex abuse that occur within the family in this country.
That's interesting, and I don't know what the statistics are, but certainly that's a large part of it. And I think it also just, what you said, Juan, goes right to the larger question of how effective is the law going to be? Because if a sex offender is out, and even if there is community notification, if that sex offender is going to offend, nothing's going to stop him from doing it. Whether it's somebody he knows or a stranger, all he has to do is get in his car and go a few blocks away or go to another town or another state, which is why one of the criticisms of the law is that it's really designed to drive people out of your neighborhood and drive them into somebody else's neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, the Cefeli crime, the reason I never mentioned the victim is that the victim was related somehow to Cefeli.
Well, I think it's a key point, Juan, that you raise, and a very important point to end on, and that is the fact that most sexual abusers of kids are from the families of those kids.
Yeah, they're usually they're uncles or cousins or fathers or mothers, and that's where the bulk of the problem still exists in this country.
And so what do doctors and people you've interviewed, counselors, say can be, what kind of, can it be legislation that deals with this
issue? Well, clearly,
I mean,
sexual abuse within the family is a much more difficult situation because very often families don't even want to bring it to court because it tears apart at a family and at the relationships within a family. It causes everyone to choose sides so many of these crimes do go unreported, never appear, never come to court, but yet it's a lot easier to focus on this stranger, the one that no one knows, the outsider who's responsible for these attacks on our young people.
Well, wrapping up, Tim O'Brien, the piece that you did in the New Jersey Law Journal, Would Megan's Law Have Saved Megan? And it goes on to say her neighbors knew a child sex offender had been living among them for 6 years, has infuriated many members of the block that Megan lived on. You're a persona non grata there, to say the least. Why are people so angry?
Well, because part of the story said that I reported that at least four people told me that the Kankas knew. They didn't know necessarily about Temendiquas, but they knew about Cefeli. And it sort of guts the law. At least, again, one reason we did the story was because when the law was passed, it was rushed through at breakneck speed, and it literally passed the state assembly in 15 days, a package of 9 bills without dissent. And the rules of the House were suspended on an emergency basis because the leader of the House at the time, Speaker Chuck Haitian, who was running for the United States Senate and in the heat of a campaign, suspended the rules because he said that children are at risk and thousands of children could be molested. It was very poor lawmaking, and it was all based on this assumption that nobody knew. And, of course, that leads to the larger question. Had they known, would it have helped? And basically what my story says is they did know and it didn't help.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Tim O'Brien, who is a senior writer at the New Jersey Law Journal, in this first week of the trial of the alleged murderer of 7-year-old Megan Kanka in New Jersey. We thank you for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Working in a nursing home is now more dangerous than working in a coal mine, in a steel mill, in a warehouse, or a paper mill. In fact, healthcare work is one of the most dangerous jobs in America. Here to talk about what's being called an epidemic of healthcare worker injuries sweeping America are two guests. We're joined by Bill Borwegan. He is the Health and Safety Director of the 1.1 million strong Service Employees International Union, which is the fastest growing union in the country. The SEIU represents some 450,000 healthcare workers. And we're joined from California by Bill Charney. He is Environmental Health Director at San Francisco General Hospital and the organizer of an upcoming emergency conference on the epidemic of healthcare worker injury in the United States. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and why don't we begin with Bill Borwegan in Washington, D.C. Can you just describe the scope of the problem? I think it'll surprise many to know that healthcare work is among the most dangerous in this country.
Thank you very much. Actually, a higher number of injuries occur in the healthcare sector than any other sector of the economy, and it's also the injury and illness rates are actually growing rather dramatically as opposed to in other sectors where we're seeing a decline. Since 1980, we've seen a 52% jump in injury rates in hospitals and a 62% increase in long-term care injury rates. Yet in construction and manufacturing, where OSHA spends somewhere around 85% of their inspection hours, we've seen a 22% drop in injury and illness rates over the past decade. So we're looking at really an epidemic in one of the fastest growing sectors of the economy and they now have one of the highest injury and illness rates.
Now, I understand that there are as many, Bill, as 800,000 needle stick injuries to health workers every year.
Well, in fact, Juan, that number may be underreported by we're not sure what factor. There may be actually many more needle stick injuries than that. What we do know is that about a plane load of healthcare workers every year die just from hepatitis B infections alone, and many more. Others contract HIV from needle stick injuries. And the biggest growing threat that is faced in our country, not only in healthcare but in public health in general, is the threat posed by hepatitis C, which is which has about a 20-year latency period before basically your liver gives out, and it's going to be, I think it already is the number one reason why there are liver transplants going on in this country. And these can easily be prevented by using safer medical devices, but the healthcare industry and the manufacturers have been remiss in adopting these safer devices that could today eliminate 85% of these million-plus needle stick injuries.
Well, William Charney, you're environmental health director at San Francisco General Hospital. I'm surprised you even go into the hospital every day, considering what a dangerous place it is to work.
Well, we're trying to create some of the systems and organizations that are going to protect healthcare workers on the job. It's a gigantic task.
What are the biggest complaints that come to you of the healthcare workers in your hospital?
Well, healthcare workers are an extremely exposed population of workers. A partial list or a partial roll call of exposures or infectious diseases from needle sticks, including but not limited to HIV and hepatitis B and C, infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, radiation exposures from radiological equipment, diagnostic and therapeutic radioisotopes, chemical exposures from cold sterilants such as chemotherapeutic drugs, waste anesthetic gases, sterilizer gases such as ethylene oxide, laser plumes, aerosolized drugs such as ribavirin and pentamidine, ergonomic injury, violence, especially in psychiatric hospitals or psychiatric units, shift work hazards, reproduction hazards. I mean, the list goes on and on.
And I understand also that, for instance, among nurses, aides, and those who have to actually move patients around, that the degree of back injury reports is astronomical?
Well, that's exactly correct. The back injury rates are an epidemic within this epidemic. It's in all sectors report really, really high back injury rates. Back injuries account for about 45% of all lost day work injuries to healthcare workers, compared to 27% of other occupations.
Why then is Bill? Why then is this problem escalating? Where is the government regulation or oversight by the healthcare industry itself?
Which bill are you?
Bill Borwiggin.
Well, obviously, you know, we've seen some backsliding going on in the last couple of years at the federal level dealing with worker health and safety. OSHA was fighting for its survival in the last Congress. There'll soon be new legislation introduced in the next couple of weeks that will also attempt to emasculate OSHA's ability to do their job. But clearly, OSHA has yet to really rise above the industrial era. And a lot of their regulations were set to deal with manufacturing and construction. They're really in a 1960s, 1970s mindset, and they haven't really begun to deal with the fact that the vast majority of injuries and illnesses today occur in the service sector, and in particular the healthcare sector, and they have very few standards to address the hazards that affect the majority of workers in this country, whether we're looking at ergonomic hazards, back injuries. As Mr. Charney said, nurses' aides have the highest rate of back injuries than any occupation in the country. Mm. These are some of the most overworked, underpaid workers in the country, predominantly female. Significant percentage of people of color work in these workplaces. These are healthcare workers that don't have health insurance in many instances. These are the people that we're talking about, some of the most exploited workers in the country that in addition to being exploited, also have some of the most dangerous jobs.
We're talking to Bill Borwiggin and Bill Charney. Bill Borwiggin, the Health and Safety Director of the Service Employees International Union, fastest growing union in the country, represents close to 500,000 healthcare workers. And William Charney, Environmental Health Director at San Francisco General Hospital, who's putting together an emergency conference on the epidemic of healthcare worker injury in the United States. Let's talk a little about HMOs and the corporatization of healthcare and the role that that plays in worker injury. Bill Borwiggin, let's start with you.
Well, this is really where we're seeing, not only are we not dealing with the existing problem of these traditional hazards that Bill Charney talked about, But actually, the problem is getting much worse. We're seeing new hazards like latex allergies, hepatitis C, as I mentioned. But it's all being exacerbated really by the corporatization of healthcare. And what we're seeing is restructuring, downsizing, de-skilling, compression of job classifications, really the whole corporatization of profits over patients, the drive to, we've heard of drive-through surgery and the speed-ups, and the fact that the people that are in the hospitals are sicker, and also more of the nurses are having to take care of more of the patients. I think it's quite startling. I was looking recently at a survey that was done by the American Journal of Nursing, and they found that they surveyed over 7,000 nurses, and over a third of those nurses said they would not even recommend the healthcare facility where they work for one of their own family members because they felt that the level of care had eroded to that degree.
Bill Charney, in terms of the advances in medicine, whether it's in chemotherapy or in radiation treatments or whatever, what about the standards of worker exposure that the government should be attempting to set with a lot of these as more drugs and more esoteric treatments come on the online?
Well, there's a range of lack of regulation for all these new technologies. They added chemical treatments, medical technology, without first testing for occupational risk, whereby resulting in healthcare workers being exposed to different types of methodologies where we have no idea what the downstream, either acute or chronic effect is going to be.
Could you give us some examples? Or?
Sure. There are plenty of examples of this. For example, there are new inhalation anesthetic agents that they use in the operating rooms. And there are three new agents, isoflurane, suprane, sevoflurane, which have been introduced with absolutely no exposure standards. Aerosolized medications like ribavirin and pentamidine. The former was a discovered teratogen. The latter is a suspected carcinogen. They were introduced into the alchemy of clinical treatment without any toxicology data and without any safeguards for the healthcare worker.
Teratogen being something that causes birth defects?
Exactly. Electrocautery and laser plumes are carcinogenic and can transmit bioviruses like human papilloma, and yet there's no mandated regulations that these plumes have to be scavenged or controlled. The same thing with laser treatments. The new laser treatments are being introduced without any testing for downstream occupational health effects. Formaldehyde, which is ubiquitous in hospitals, is a carcinogen, and exposed often exceeding recommended threshold levels. And the threshold levels, or what's the allowable legal limit for formaldehyde, is constantly being reduced and is now down to 0.75 parts per million because they know that this is a very dangerous chemical.
Well, Bill Charney, what are healthcare workers, everyone from, paramedics, nurses, to doctors, doing at San Francisco General Hospital to protect themselves?
Well, San Francisco General has a lot of the same problems that all the other healthcare facilities in this country have. I mean, we're trying to slowly catch up to the problems that exist and introduce safeguards and programs and technology and design engineering to protect healthcare workers on the job. But as Bill Borwegan has mentioned, the problems are becoming more and more exacerbated, especially with the introduction of managed care and the corporatization of medicine. The Minnesota Nurses Association just finished a study where in the state of Minnesota they found that since the introduction of managed care, healthcare worker injuries have increased by 61%. These are difficult times.
What do they attribute it to?
Well, they attribute it to a lot of the things that Bill Borwegan has mentioned, especially downsizing, where you have more patients with less people taking care of them. There is de-skilling, where in the past you would have a registered nurse taking care of patients. You now have LVNs, taking care of patients.
LVNs are?
Are licensed vocational nurses and don't have the same training as registered nurses. You have a greater acuity. In other words, they're getting patients. We have a factory mentality of medicine now with profits being the bottom line. Hospitals are taking patients in and getting them out a lot faster. Therefore, you have a much sicker patient. And if you have a much sicker patient with a less skilled healthcare worker taking care of them, you have a formula for disaster. It's happening at San Francisco General. It's happening in hospitals all over the country. It's happening in nursing homes all over the country. The nursing home injury has doubled in the last 10 years. It's basically leading the way in the climb and the most dubious distinction of being the most dangerous place to be.
Beside the Minnesota study, have there been any more epidemiological studies of what's going on with the health of healthcare workers?
Well, yeah, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or the Department of Labor, keeps fairly concise data on what's going on in both the states where healthcare facilities are and both on a national level. There are two different codes that they work with, and they follow this fairly closely. For example, in 1992, private healthcare services employed 8.5 million workers, and there were nearly 700,000 work-related injuries and illnesses reported. Home healthcare aides, for example, have an annual back injury rate that's three times higher than we find for nurses aides and nurses in healthcare, in acute care. And acute care hospitals are already at epidemic levels. That's a Bureau of Labor Statistics piece of data. I mean, wherever you look, you find the data. The data is there. There were 1,000 cases of hepatitis B in 1994 due to occupational exposure. 2,200 cases of occupationally acquired cases of hepatitis C. 52 known cases of confirmed HIV serial conversion and 111 suspected cases of occupationally acquired HIV infection.
Bill Cherney, let me ask Bill Borwegan, of the healthcare workers in this country, first of all, how many are there and how many are unionized? And what does SEIU do in this case? I mean, what do you offer people as you attempt to organize healthcare workers around the country?
Well, depending on how you count, there's approximately 8 million healthcare workers in the country. And in fact, very few of them are organized. The labor laws in this country don't make it very easy to organize workers. Management frequently hires union-busting law firms and uses Medicaid and Medicare money to pay them literally $200, $300 an hour to try to bust the unions. But we are actually having more success more recently in organizing hospital workers because of all of the rapid changes that are occurring. I think the hospital workers are coming to realize that the only way to actually exert any type of influence on management to make sure that patient care is not compromised is to work collectively and to organize into a union. When they see the government's not doing very much, the hospitals are probably, they're getting bought up by these for-profit chains. They're not actually helping the matter at all. I think workers are starting to realize that by working collectively, they're going to be stronger. We just had an election up in Pennsylvania where the nurses, the RNs, voted to join our union. There were 900 nurses, and they voted to join our union. 721 voted for the union, and 23 voted not for the union. It was one of the largest victories we've ever had, and we're starting to see that all over the country where we're aggressively speaking with workers that are calling us. Where there's interest, and I would urge healthcare workers across America that are listening to this show to feel free to call the Service Employees Union. And if you have a group of workers where you're working, feel free to call us, and we'll be more than happy to speak with you and find that if you have what it takes with your coworkers to help us form a stronger bond where we can collectively negotiate with management over these changes. That's really the most important part. By having a union, you're not out there by yourself, but you can work with your coworkers, and you have more of an equal footing to negotiate all of these changes that are occurring that not only compromise patient care but also are compromising worker health and safety.
Bill Borwegan, what is the phone number of the Service Employees International Union?
Yes, you can call us at 202-898-3200, and we'd be glad to speak with you.
That number again?
202-898-3385.
That's another number.
That was my direct line. Okay. 202-898-3200.
Okay. And Bill Charney, this emergency conference on the epidemic of healthcare worker injury in the country that's going to be taking place in San Francisco. What is the number people can call to find out about it, and when is it taking place?
It's taking place June the 12th in San Francisco. And we also have an East Coast conference that's going to be held in Massachusetts on October the 14th. So we will have an East and a West Coast conference. And the number to call is 508-393-1284.
Again?
508-393-1284.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Again, Bill Charney, Environmental Health Director at San Francisco General Hospital, and Bill Borwegan, Health and Safety Director at Service Employees International Union. I'm sure a lot of people, except for healthcare workers themselves, did not realize how dangerous the healthcare profession can be. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to go to another danger zone. We're going to look at Yugoslavia, particularly Srebrenica. This in light of the UN Tribunal verdict that has just come out earlier today. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In the first judgment issued after a full-length trial, the United Nations International Tribunal in The Hague found a defendant guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity for his part in a Serb ethnic cleansing campaign against Bosnian Muslims. 41-year-old Bosnian Serb police reservist Dusan Tadic was charged with rounding up his former Muslim neighbors in northwest Bosnia in 1992, and then having them tortured, raped, and killed in Serb-run prison camps. The UN Tribunals for Yugoslavia marked the first attempt to try war criminals before an international panel of judges since the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials after World War II. Joining us to talk about human rights abuses and the war in the former Yugoslavia is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rode. He covered the war in Yugoslavia for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's just published a new book called Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, Europe's Worst Massacre Since World War II, and he currently works for the New York Times, joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David.
Thank you.
Well, David, before we get to your breaking of the story and the Srebrenica massacre, let's get your reaction to this verdict at The Hague.
It's a small, very small first step. Mr. Tadic was a camp guard. He was the lowest level person that could be convicted of the various war crimes that were carried out in this Omarska camp early in the war. The commander of the camp is still living in Serb territory. Numerous journalists have gone and interviewed him, and at this point he hasn't been arrested. The Tribunal in General has indicted 74 people for war crimes during the war, and only 8 of them are in the Tribunal's custody.
Well, David, could you tell us first, summarize for us the dimensions of the massacre that your book deals with?
I focus on the fall of Srebrenica, which was later in the war. Srebrenica was the first UN-declared safe area. It was in 1993, the UN promised to protect it, and they took the guns and artillery that the Bosnian Muslims in that town had away from them and promised to protect them with NATO airstrikes. 2 years later, the town fell, and currently there are 7,079 men missing, according to the International Red Cross, from the town. 15,000 of the Bosnian Muslim men that were in the town after it fell tried to make a 40-mile trek through enemy territory through a wooded area. They were hunted down by Bosnian Serb soldiers. General Ratko Mladic, who has been indicted now for what happened, was in command of these units. There were, it appears, 3,000 men killed in mass executions and 4,000 in ambushes. And this, at this point, Mr. Mladic is also one of the people who's been indicted for war crimes but not held free. And so today's ruling is interesting in terms of it is the very first ruling, but we've only got a camp guard. We have none of the commanders in charge here. This is the equivalent of a very low-level concentration camp guard being convicted, but Mr. Goebbels, for instance, or Hitler or Eichmann being allowed to remain free living in Nazi Germany after the war had ended. That's basically the situation now in the former Yugoslavia.
Why?
The reason Srebrenica fell and the sort of clear pattern it seems to be throughout the war and right now through the NATO troops that are there and the American troops that are there is a fear of Western casualties. This is an interesting situation where intervention may have made things worse. People in Srebrenica argued that they would have had a better chance to defend themselves if the UN hadn't taken their weapons away. And in the end, the Western actions sort of ended up aiding and even emboldening these executioners because the West has repeatedly blinked when confronted in Bosnia. There seemed to be a desire to look like the West was doing something in Bosnia. The UN declared Srebrenica and other towns safe areas and asked for 37,000 peacekeepers to come in and do it. The U.S. wasn't willing to send in troops then. We did send in troops in 1995 when it looked like the UN mission was collapsing. Srebrenica fell. These executions occurred, and the U.S. was forced to, I think, respond to the issue because the Clinton administration was worried about the 1996 elections. So no one is arrested because right now policymakers in the U.S. have said it is not part of NATO troops' mission to arrest war criminals. And it would take roughly, to be honest, and it's an important thing to consider, 15 American soldiers probably could die in some kind of commando raid to try to arrest General Mladic, the Bosnian Serb Army commander, or Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb president, and they're both surrounded by guards, mostly during the day.
Your book is especially critical of the French general who was a senior commander in the former Yugoslavia. Could you tell us a little bit about what was his role in relationship to this massacre?
In Srebrenica specifically, there was a problem in that the UN did not have enough troops on the ground to defend the town. There were about 750 lightly armed Dutch peacekeepers put in the town. The book actually focuses on seven real people who lived through this. Two of them are Dutch peacekeepers. Three are Bosnian Muslims. One of them is a woman who ends up negotiating for women and children in the town after it falls. And two of them are Serbs who are attacking it. The Dutch, though, were desperately trying to defend the town and not sure what to do. And they kept calling for NATO planes to come in and defend the town. But there was a French general, he referred to General Bernard Janvier, who repeatedly turned down the Dutch requests for airstrikes. The night before the town fell, General Janvier said he had spoken to a Serb general, and he told his aides, "I was able to get detailed accounts of the private deliberations that went on in the UN headquarters about what to do about Srebrenica." He told his aides, "I spoke to General Tolomir. He said the Serbs do not intend to take Srebrenica. I believe him. If I'm wrong, I'll draw my conclusions in the morning." The following day, Srebrenica fell. In the book, I allege that General Janvier, who he had repeatedly recommended before Srebrenica fell that the UN pull out of Srebrenica, and he was negligent either way. He didn't use all the tools available to him to defend the town. Whether he did that because he was Machiavellian or just purely incompetent, whether he actually believed the Serbs, I don't know, but he has never given an explanation for his actions. It's 2 years later, and it's stunning, I think, that 7,000 people are missing. If 7,000 Americans were missing or 7,000 French were missing, there would have been some kind of investigation. There's been no investigation into the UN's role in the fall of Srebrenica.
We're talking to David Rode, who's written the book Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, Europe's Worst Massacre Since World War II. I want to talk about your investigation of the massacre. What does it mean to say you were the first to report on it? Wasn't it well known at the time, considering how big it was?
It was, but the question was the scale, and it was interesting. One of the things I found, and one of the reasons the book focuses on seven people, and they're all on different sides in this, is how we all rationalize and how people were conditioned to carry out these executions. The Dutch peacekeepers themselves saw, I was able to find out, roughly 1,600 old men were taken away by the Serbs for questioning as potential war criminals after the town fell. The old men had gone to the Dutch base in town hoping for protection, but the Dutch did very little to protect them. And the Dutch rationalized themselves as to what happened. So after the town fell, this column of men set out through the woods. One of the men would later describe it as the marathon of death, this 40-mile trek through Serb territory. Roughly half of them showed up in central Bosnia, and so roughly 7,000 or 8,000 had never come out of this woods, had never emerged from this trek. And there were reports, there were one or two survivors, but no one was quite clear what exactly had happened. In August, the U.S. released satellite photos of what they suspected were mass graves, and I was able, the first person to get in, I had basically a fax copy of the satellite photo that had run in a newspaper to get to that place. I found empty ammunition boxes at large areas that had been freshly dug up, some documents from Srebrenica itself, and this was again in the middle of Serb territory. And finally, there was a decomposed human leg jutting from the ground near one of the graves.
So that's how you found the mass graves.
That was the first trip, and then after that, I ended up finding nine survivors of executions. They weren't the first survivors to be interviewed, but it was nine. It wasn't two or three. They described five locations where executions occurred, not a single execution. And they described General Mladic, the Bosnian Serb Army commander, being present at the executions. He greeted prisoners by saying, "Hello, neighbors. You will not be harmed. You'll soon be exchanged." He would then leave the sites, and within a few minutes, groups of men would be taken away and executed, unfortunately. And then on a second trip, I went back into Serb territory and found two more graves. I was able to corroborate what I found, corroborated the accounts of five of the survivors, but I was arrested by the Serbs and jailed for 10 days. But I was able to find these two additional graves and confirm the scale of it. And it seemed that the reporters, everyone, didn't want to face the scale of this. We thought, well, maybe the Bosnian Muslims are exaggerating the numbers. You know, maybe it was a few hundred people, not 7,000.
I remember your pieces coming out in the Christian Science Monitor then, and how dramatic it was and how significant to find these mass graves. What happened to you in jail for those 10 days?
I was treated fairly well. I saw it as a calculated risk in that, to be honest, I wouldn't do the same thing in some parts of the United States that I did in Bosnia. And one way to look at Bosnia is not this model of ancient ethnic hatreds. It's to see it as a former communist country. There have been authoritarian regimes in control there for centuries, and especially the last 50 years under communism. So there was a very little chance that I would be arrested and some local policeman would hurt me. I knew that if something was going to happen to me, it would go to the top levels of the government there. The first 5 days I was held, they questioned me. They were convinced I was a CIA agent. The person who questioned me kept saying, "Mr. David, you are very clever, but you are not clever enough. You must answer the three questions if you want to leave. What is your rank? Who is your commander in the CIA? And what is your mission?" And I laughed at first, but they were very serious about this. And then this again gets back to conditioning and rationalizations. And the propaganda on the Serb side was incredibly strong. They were told that there was an international Muslim conspiracy against them, that OPEC controlled CNN, and that's why CNN kept reporting these atrocities that most Serbs don't believe occurred. And right now, the reason the war crimes process is so important is that the decent Serbs, I was in jail with Serbs who were very nice people, but they didn't believe these executions occurred, can see the proof before the tribunal, so that it can be much like the process in Western Europe where Germans were forced to face what their leadership had carried out, and where individuals are blamed for what happened. Nazis carried out atrocities, not all Germans are blamed for it. The same thing needs to happen in the former Yugoslavia, and I'm very hopeful that there can be a lasting peace there if that happens.
You also describe in the book the fixation of UN officials with the negative media that their whole mission was receiving. It seems almost bizarre, their fixation with this.
Yeah, Yasushi Akashi, who was the head of the civilian head of the UN mission, was almost obsessed with keeping the mission neutral. And my real critique with them is that they didn't use all the tools they had open to them. Mr. Akashi Close air support was supposed to be something available to UN troops to call in instantly if they were ever threatened. NATO planes could come in and sort of buzz the position or drop flares to intimidate the Serbs that were firing at UN peacekeepers. Mr. Akashi created an 18-point checklist for close air support. All the answers had to be found out before it could be approved. One of the questions was, how will this affect the image of the United Nations? The day after Srebrenica fell, Mr. Akashi was very concerned about the image of the United Nations, and in private meetings I was able to get access to, he was speaking to aides, and he said that his concern was, what we need are pictures on TV of the Dutch peacekeepers in Srebrenica feeding refugees, not what's happening to the Dutch refugees, where are the Serbs taking away these old men, these kind of issues. So it was very frustrating, and what happened to them. There was a pattern of military officials becoming frustrated and maybe it's Stockholm syndrome, but being furious with the people they were supposed to be protecting. Many of the Dutch in Srebrenica resented the Muslims who they were supposed to be protecting. And when you send soldiers on these missions and they're not clear missions and they're not fully armed, and in a way, if they're not ready to take casualties and fight, they become very frustrated. In a way, it's unfair to, even to the military themselves, to send them
David
on these
kind
of missions.
To summarize, you basically suggest an endgame that the UN intentionally allowed Srebrenica to fall.
General Janvier was the key person in all this, and he has never explained his actions. He may have himself intentionally allowed Srebrenica to fall. He may have had secret instructions from France. I found no evidence that there was a larger conspiracy involving the U.S. and France. But why General Janvier did what he did, I cannot understand how he's been able for 2 years to not answer questions as to why this occurred. People in Srebrenica expected these airstrikes to come. The Bosnian Muslims in the town panicked when they didn't come. The Dutch peacekeepers in the town panicked when they didn't come. And I just think it's crucial that he answer for what he did. One of the we've created a pattern now of, unfortunately, embittered the Bosnian Muslims in this town. And to be honest, there is some attempts by Iran to try to gain a foothold in Bosnia. And most Bosnians aren't very religious, but they are now very embittered towards the U.S. One of the people in my book is a 25-year-old who was captured fleeing through the woods. He was taken to a gym. General Mladic assured him that he wouldn't be harmed. And he and his cousin were then loaded in the back of a truck and blindfolded. They were driven down a dirt road. After 5 minutes, they were pulled out of the back of the truck. And his cousin called out his name, and this Mevlut Noric was his name. Mevlut took his cousin's hand, and his cousin said, "They're going to kill us, they're going to kill us." And Mevlut said, "No, you're wrong." Just then, an execution squad opened up on them, and Mevlut survived by hiding under his cousin for the next 6 hours as more and more groups of prisoners were brought to this site. At the end of the day, the Serbs themselves seemed to lose their nerve. They didn't want to guard the bodies in the field, and Mevlut was able to escape after crawling out from underneath his cousin. He initially was eager to testify before the war crimes tribunal, but with the lack of arrests and the lack of accountability in terms of the UN and why Janvier did what he did, he's grown very cynical about the process. He wants to live with Serbs again. He just wants to see the Serb leadership to carry this out held accountable.
But you say the bitterness that exists toward the United States on the part of the Bosnians, but there are many in this country who feel the United States should not have been risking lives, sending troops halfway around the world for essentially a civil war that did not involve our country. How would you respond to that?
I would say if that's the position, then we shouldn't create a war crimes tribunal. We're trying to. There seems to be an attempt by the Clinton administration to have its cake and eat it too, in terms of getting the political boost of creating a war crimes tribunal, promising to bring people to justice, and then not doing it. This wasn't a distant atrocity that everyone ignored. This was the case of the West coming into a town, taking away the guns these people had to defend themselves, and promising to protect them, and then almost repeatedly backing down to the Serbs. The U.S. policy in this situation aided and I think even emboldened the executioners. We repeatedly in Bosnia backed off, and more General Mladic, he strutted around Srebrenica after he conquered it, the Serb general. He told Muslims, "Allah can't help you now, but Mladic can." This was classic megalomania, classic racism. We created the situation, so I think we have a responsibility to do this, to either arrest the war criminals or just get rid of the war crimes tribunal. The verdict today was a good first step, but this is a very low-level camp guard. And there will be another war there is what most people predict that I speak to. And you couldn't, what would happen in Western Europe if, you know, the Germans' leadership, the Nazi leadership was left in power? This is the equivalent of letting Hitler and his people basically retire to country homes. That's what's happened in Bosnia now.
Well, David Rode, I want to thank you very much for your reporting over the years and for this book, Endgame. Again, the book is called Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica, Europe's Worst Massacre Since World War II. It's just been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Well, you've been listening to Democracy Now!, which is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. In Washington, Kenneth Mason has been our engineer. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 and order a cassette copy. That's 1-800-735-0230. Friday on Democracy Now! We'll be speaking with Ralph Nader about the tobacco industry. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!